Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
As of the date of this recording, our annual Apologetics Canada Conference is tomorrow. Just last night at Westside Church, we had a sort of a pre-conference event like we often do every year.
Yep.
And we invited our guests, Dr. Andy Bannister and Ian Bushfield. We've been talking about them every week, so you should be pretty familiar by now as to who they are. Ian Bushfield is the executive director of the BC Humanist Association. And for those of you that have been following Apologetics Canada, Andy Bannister should be a familiar name to you. He is the director of Solus Center for Public Christianity. He's the author of The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. Yeah, and so last night...
Steve Kim moderated it.
First time. I have a new appreciation for Justin Brierley, so he's my new role model. And we have Dr. Andy Bannister in our studio with us. Hello, Andy.
Hello, hello, Steve. Great to be with you.
Good to have you here, man.
It's exciting to be here. What a venue. It's a very special space.
It has been a little confusing, though, having you here.
Mm-hmm.
We've already been in the offices walking around, and we're not quite sure who's talking to who. Hey, Andy.
Yes.
You know, it's like, we're not sure. Which Andy do you want? So,
well, exactly. There's only one in my view, I'm afraid, Andy.
You're the British Andy. I'm the American Andy.
That's right. We think of you as the colonies, my friend. That's what we call it. So
The Yankee. But it's great having you here, man. And what we wanted to do in this podcast was just take a moment to talk about last night and what was discussed, and begin to go a little deeper on these issues. You know, in the dialogue, there was only so much time, and with some of the questions that came up, there's only so much time. But we wanted to take a moment just to analyze what took place.
As we get into it, just overall impression of, just from your perspective, overall impression of how the night went. What did you think?
Yeah, well, let me start there by saying I think these kind of dialogues, and so for those, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with exactly what we did. So it was myself, and then we had Ian from the humanist side, and then Steve, you moderated. Mm-hmm. And so rather than a debate or, you know, great long speeches, you put questions to both of us. We got a discussion going around this whole question of where do human rights best fit? Do they best fit under Christianity? Do they best fit under humanism? But the dialogue format, I think, is hugely important. I'd love to start there. And I think it's important really for a couple of reasons. I think people love to see an intelligent conversation rather than a slanging match. Mm-hmm. I think there's something as a Christian about modeling the fact that if we believe that Christianity is true, we don't need to be afraid about giving others equal airtime, because Christianity stands head and shoulders, not because we have to manipulate the evening, but just because it's true.
I actually had a lady come to me after the event, and that's exactly what she said to me. She goes, I love this. You know, as Christians, we don't need to be afraid to have these kinds of events. You know, we're not afraid of the truth, right?
Yeah.
And don't you also think, Andy, that one of the other keys to having a dialogue like this is really, in many ways, you're modeling what it looks like.
Well, I think you do two things, aren't you? You're modeling what it looks like. And it was great. I had an email this morning, actually, someone who sort of looked me up on Facebook or from somewhere just saying exactly that. Who somebody said, thank you to you and Steve, you were mentioned as well, for just modeling, you know, generous Christian engagement with somebody who believes differently to us. And then the other thing I think I've learned about dialogues as well is debates. Both sides often tend to go away sort of thinking their team won. That's the nature of a debate, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a hockey match. You always think your team did really well, even if it's the Leafs, right? I think with a dialogue, what you're modeling is that the Christian faith can stand up on equal footing. And I hope and pray there would have been skeptics last night going away, not necessarily convinced by what I said or by, you know, some of what you said, Steve, in a couple of places, but going away going, oh, hang on a minute. Now, those Christians aren't, you know, crazy rednecks. You know, that Bannister guy, he'd read some stuff. There were some things that made me think. And likewise, actually, for Christians, I want Christians going away, to be fair, thinking the other side. I don't want Christians going away thinking, oh, you know, atheists have got nothing at all. They're all a bunch of Fruit Loops. There's good material on both sides. There's a conversation to be had.
One of the things that I was excited about was a part of this dialogue was to promote the Human Project, of which we showed two of the videos last night. And I thought it was very interesting that Ian Bushfield really liked these videos. He thought they were fantastic. And in fact, he actually appreciated what I had to say too, kicking off the evening. It was like, I agreed with everything this guy just said. Now, obviously, I know he's going to bring Jesus into this conversation eventually, but I thought that was I thought that was a real win. That what a great resource to get people talking, and that he saw this as is a very natural conversation.
There tends to be this divide, right? When there is when there are differences of opinion, people tend to focus on where we disagree. But as we found out last night, as we were talking with Ian Bushfield, as we were talking with Andy Bannister, we had a great deal in agreement. Sure, there were some fundamental things that we disagreed on, but there were also a lot of things that we did agree on, and I think that really came through.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think the other thing as well that comes out of last night, and I just assure readers, you haven't listeners, you haven't bribed me with a $10 sort of a bribe to say this. I think it shows that the genius of the work you folks have done on the Human Project, because I think sometimes as Christians we come in with our skeptical friends at the sort of God angle. Let's talk about, does God exist? Does God not exist? And so forth. The thing is, I don't think that's a question many of our secular friends are actually thinking about. Mm-hmm. But everybody has a view on what it means to be human. And I think when you start exploring the what is the nature of humanity, where are human rights grounded, what does human dignity look like, I think that gets you to the God question. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a brilliant place to start, because everyone's got an opinion, everyone's got a vested, you know, something, some skin in that game, because we're all human.
And I think to make that point is the fact that we had around 800 people out last night, and there were a number of skeptics that were in the audience, and we saw that during Q&A.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I sent an email out to Ian this morning saying, you know, thank you for participating with us. And he wrote back very kindly, and he said, yeah, I heard from some humanists that, you know, once the thing got going, I mean, the time just flew by in a really good way. Mm-hmm. Right? They really enjoyed their time there last night as well.
What a great win. And I think you're right, Andy. When you ask the questions that people are asking, you know, and you're seeking to, you know, dialogue on those questions, they're going to come. They're naturally going to want to participate in those dialogues. And then you have an opportunity to go deeper in those questions. So if we're all asking those, you know, questions about, you know, what is the foundation for human rights? And we're wrestling through that. Well, what a great opportunity through bringing up that question to demonstrate how the gospel humanizes, to talk about how Christianity answers this question in a robust manner and gets people thinking, not just on these questions, but gets people thinking about those deeper foundational issues, particularly in this case, the gospel.
I think you're absolutely right. And I forget who sort of I first heard this illustration from, that, you know, Christians were very fond of going around saying things like Jesus is the answer, but maybe we need to pause and ask, what's the question? Mm-hmm. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the gospel profoundly engages the questions of the age. But one mistake we sometimes make as Christians is assuming we know what the questions are. And I think that causes huge problems. It shuts conversations down. People think we're arrogant because we're not listening. That you never lose in an evangelistic conversation by taking time to listen, to ascertain what the questions are, and then go, okay, it's a really good, yeah, it's really good what you've shared there, and I think the gospel has something to say here.
Speaking of that, I have to confess, now again, I obviously am a fan of the Human Project, but one of the things Steve Kim and I were talking about in the car was through the dialogue that took place and the Q&A that happened, the four questions that we deal with in that project, what is human? What's the value of human life? What leads to human flourishing? And how should humans live? Those were the four questions that came up over and over again and were clearly the foundational questions that we're building on one another.
Yeah, it was very gratifying.
Actually, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But let's jump into things then. Let's talk about how the dialogue went, what sorts of things surprised you, Andy, and now that we've got more time to dialogue on this, I'm sure that there were people that were at that event and would like to hear us go deeper on some of these questions. Yeah. So
the one issue that I wanted to keep bringing it back to, because I think that was sort of the point of this dialogue, is where do you get human rights from? What do you found it on? How does Christianity make sense of a concept like human rights, and how does secular humanism make sense of a concept like human rights? One of the first things that Andy brought up was, well, look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. See how this starts off.
Yeah, so I think we began last night by talking about the fact, if you've never read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Just Google it. Just Google Universal Declaration of Human Rights or UDHR. And particularly if you look at the first couple of paragraphs, it's very, very clear that the framers of that document were basing what they were saying on beliefs about human dignity and value. And they use that kind of language, that there's an innate dignity, value, equality that human beings have. And it's because of that we have these inalienable rights that they can go on and unfold. And what I wanted to do with Ian was just press, I think, into that question of, does that claim actually stand up? Does that starting point work if you are a secular humanist? And I think one of the things we danced around, we may talk about this.
And Andy, starting point, you mean inherent dignity?
Inherent dignity. And I think what was interesting, and I was reflecting on this morning, actually, that a number of times throughout the evening, Ian kept saying, well, the question is, are human rights something that we've invented as human beings because we think they're lovely, or are human rights something that God gave to us? And again, because it's a dialogue, not a debate. But I think if we'd had a chance to go around that area again, I'd have looked at Ian and said, look, the Christian position is not that God's, rather like the Ten Commandments, has sort of carved, human rights, right to freedom of speech, right to a British accent in a public place, whatever, onto tablets of stone and given them to us. It's that God has given us dignity and value and worth for two reasons. One, because we bear his image, Genesis 1, 26 and 27, but also because God has loved us supremely in what he's done in the person of Christ. And on that foundation block, you can then build. And yes, there's work to be done. And Christians sometimes can get a bit lazy and go, oh yeah, the Bible and human rights. It's not that straightforward, but it is as straightforward as, is there a foundation there, or are we just sort of making stuff up as we go?
Let's talk about that, because I think it's important that we explain what inherent dignity means. What do we mean by inherent dignity?
By inherent, and in the way that we use that term philosophically in anthropology, and when we talk about inherent dignity, what we mean is if you have inherent dignity, Andy, it means that you have value and worth just because of your human nature, not because of what you can bring to me, not because, you're my buddy, not because you make me a nice cup of tea, not because you give me $20, not because of any instrumental value that you have to me. You have value just because you have value, just because have value. Now, you may be listening to this thinking, does that matter? Well, it does matter, because, for example, just to give you one example of where this becomes hugely important, the whole question of whether people in our society who are perhaps profoundly disabled and have nothing they can offer back, do they have worth? Or do we just look at them and go, well, you're just a drain economically on society and our resources, so we're going to, dispose of you? And that's a live issue. We touched briefly on this last night. Look what's going on with Down syndrome right now and the attempts by some countries to just sort of rid themselves entirely of people with Downs forever.
And this really got into the crux of the conversation, in that, this idea of an inherent dignity, in this idea that you're getting out there, Andy, that you've come into the world with this dignity. No one has conferred that dignity onto you. We're saying that, like you said, just by the very nature of being human, you have this dignity, which raises the question, well, where did that come from? Where did that dignity come from? Because it seems, as that dialogue continued with Ian, that he saw, dignity as relative.
Well, it's very interesting looking back what Ian did over the evening. And again, I was sort of lying in bed this morning, kind of thinking about it. What Ian did last night, for folks listening who weren't there, I think very quickly he tried to take it away from dignity. And he could try to construct human rights in terms of, human rights are simply a way of living peacefully together. So I agree, that you won't hit me, therefore I won't hit you, and therefore we have a lovely, peaceful afternoon. But of course, the problem is that only gets you so far. That's basically nothing more than a non-aggression treaty. But then towards the end of the evening, he suddenly started picking up and using dignity language again. And then even more shockingly, if you recall last night, right at the very end, he came right out and said, oh, I guess I'm a relativist, and almost felt the need to apologize for that. And for folks who aren't, familiar with the term relativist, that's the idea that you recognize that, everyone constructs moral truths for themselves. I've decided that it's a good idea not to murder innocent Canadians or even Americans. But you've got a different set of values. And hey, it's good for you, good for me. No one gets to impose their values on anybody else. It was a real shame, I think, that he introduced that with about 90 seconds on the clock. Because if he'd done it at the top of the hour, that would have been worth pursuing.
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to point out there was, because he just like you said, he said human rights is a concept that we develop. It is this institution that we develop along the way so that we can live peaceably with each other, so that, you know, society can flourish, so on and so forth. And my thought was, well, what does that flourishing look like? What if somebody comes along and says, well, I don't care for your flourishing, really. On relativism, how do you justifiably condemn that? So my question was, what makes human rights binding on everybody, right? And that was one of the problems.
Which would be coming back to the inherent idea.
Right, yeah. Which is one of the problems with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right? Because it's a declaration. It's not law. It's not binding
on anybody. When you read that declaration, there is no argumentation given for why it is that this is the case.
Right.
Or that you should believe that.
It is just assumed, and it's presupposed as you start off the document.
Yeah, and I think a couple of issues flow from there that we didn't touch on last night, but obviously we're going deeper into them now. I mean, one is that, of course, if human rights is something we discover and we develop, that presumably means anybody who lived before the time we develop it didn't have them. I mean, develop is an interesting word. I mean, I've got an IT background, and I still do some software development. You know, before Microsoft developed Microsoft Office, nobody had Microsoft Office. No one had it in the 1970s. So presumably, before the development of human rights, no one had them. So therefore, it was okay to go around murdering people and doing whatever you wanted before 1948 because they hadn't been developed. That's an interesting question. Right. But your question about how that then imposes anything on you or I is interesting. I mean, if they're just a human creation pulled out of nothing, I mean, if I sit here and go, I have a right to Tim Hortons Boston cream donuts, Andy, go get me one.
Which he loves, by the way.
Which I do love,
and
by the way.
I had last night,
product placement. You know, I suspect that you're not going to go, oh, yes, you've got that right, Andy. I'll be right back with a tray of the things. I guess you'd look at me and go, yeah, you can say everything you want, mate. You're not getting the donut until you give us half an hour of content.
We pay him in donuts.
Oh, yeah.
So last night, I remember I tried to bring it to that issue of, well, how do you ground this? And because one of the things that he said was, well, it's developed. So I thought,
if you're talking about development, you have some sort of goal in mind. I mean, that came out with just even this idea of human flourishing, which got tossed around quite a bit. But who's flourishing? I mean, what does that flourishing look like? It would seem then that if something's developing, that you would have some sort of end in mind. Because one of the things that Ian talked about that I thought was interesting is this idea of progressing, that it's getting better, that the more that you progress, the better that it will become. He had very much of a naturalistic understanding of that. You know, poor ideas are going to die out and the good ones will survive, which quite honestly, I wanted to see that teased out a little bit more. I mean,
I thought it was interesting that he thought, you know, like in Canada, for example, you know, we're doing much better than some of the other countries around the world in terms of human flourishing, but we have more work to do. And the thought in my mind was, to what end? You know, how are you measuring that better or worse? Because he did say that, you know, like, I think there are better societies and there are worse societies. I think Canada is pretty good, but I don't think it's perfect. You know, so I was thinking, how are you measuring that? Right? Mm-hmm. Without some kind of a reference, fixed reference point, how would you measure better or worse?
Let's use an example such as murder. So is human flourishing a society in which there's less murder? Well, we could create a society in which there's no murder, but it just requires a lot of slavery. Would that be an okay society?
Hugely significant. It was interesting that I had a conversation at the end of the evening with an enthusiastic humanist who came and sought me out. Ugh. And under his arm, he had a copy of the book by Steven Pinker, Better Angels of Our Nature, right? And if you're not familiar with that book, Steven is a Canadian humanist, and his argument is that, you know, society is just getting better and better and better and better, and, you know, look at the wonderful things that liberal humanism is doing. And one of the critiques that's been made of Steven's book, not even by Christians, by his own team, by other atheist reviewers, is it all depends on the metric you use. So yeah, sure, if you look at the number of people killed in wars, apart from the blip of the 20th century, you know, things are leveling off. But if you take a different metric, let's suppose people who are subject to bullying, for example. Technology has made that vastly worse. As a young person today, you are facing a tsunami of bullying, many young people. That was unthought of in previous generations because you've got social media, and so this stuff follows you home. Or look at things like sexting or revenge porn or those other phenomena.
Or anxiety and depression. Yeah,
that weren't known before. And so to go, the response to people like Stephen is therefore simply, it just depends on how you draw the metric, and you can absolutely define it in such a way that makes your society look wonderful. Other societies may look at you and go, well, just hang on a moment. So that's a hugely important question about how we define human flourishing. And I think the issue is, Steve, because you raised it, I don't think you can answer that question unless you know what it is a human being is supposed to be. I mean, very quick analogy, right? I mean, let's suppose you've got a group of athletes who are, you know, track and field guys. They're doing the 400 meters, and they're all practicing and wanting to get better and better and better because one of them wants to get picked for the, you know, Canadian Olympic team. How do they define flourishing as an athlete? Well, you look at what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to complete the 400 meters in as fast time as possible and beat your, you know, those who are after the same place as you. That's what flourishing looks like. There's a race, there's a purpose, there's a design, there's intentionality to the role of being an athlete. And having Olympic aspirations. Transfer that to humanity then for a moment. What is a human being supposed to be? What does a human life well lived look like? You have to answer that question first before you can answer the flourishing question. Otherwise, you've got it entirely the wrong way around.
Now, if I were to just play the devil's advocate here, I might think that, well, there are certain things about human nature that's pretty self-evident, shall we say, that everybody intuitively knows that we don't want to experience pain, we don't want to experience suffering. So the more we can reduce that, the better. So that could serve as an objective metric by which we can measure what a humanist might say, right? I'm not trying to put words in Ian's mouth, but
the suffering metric is an interesting one. But then let me push back on your pushback, or play devil's advocate to your devil's advocate. Angel's advocate. And so I'd say a couple of things. Firstly, the suffering piece is interesting. Andy, you just touched on this. If you look at here in the West, with modern medicine and so forth, we've probably got some of the lowest levels of suffering, you know, certainly through you know, disease and so forth, in any society in history. We have anesthetic, we have, you know, all kinds of really good palliative care options if you get something genuinely nasty. So suffering through disease is pretty low here in the West, and, you know, crime rates, murder rates and things down. On the other hand, incidents of anxiety and depression and suicide, all of those things, they're climbing off the charts. So clearly people are not looking at the fact that they're experiencing less suffering and going, well, hey, everything is absolutely wonderful. And I quoted briefly, no, we didn't pick up on it, but there's an amazing quote from Oscar Wilde that I threw out last night. I believe it was Oscar Wilde who once said, the greatest tragedy in a person's life is not when they are weary of suffering, but when they're weary of pleasure. When you've just got exhausted by, you know, all the trinkets and toys and distractions that society offers you, and you're fed up. You've had enough. It's just not doing it for you anymore. Then where do you go?
There's a real sense of meaninglessness there.
Boy, there is. And I meet many people like that. Talk to business leaders. I run across folks like this in their 50s who've had successful careers. You know, everything's gone well on paper, but are asking these deep questions now about, now what? What do I do with myself? So I think it's far, far more than just the absence of suffering. I think that's very problematic and very weak.
This wasn't brought up last night, but whenever I talk about suffering, one of the things that I try to delineate really carefully is the difference between the experience of harm as opposed to harm in its objective sense, right? Because suffering is an experience, but you could harm somebody without having that person experience that harm. In that sense, I wonder if suffering is adequate as a metric for a society that's flourishing.
I don't think so. Absolutely right. And then, of course, there's another problem here as well, particularly for someone like Ian, who's coming from a secular humanist background. Now, again, we don't want to put words in his mouth, but he hinted at this a couple of times, that he's probably I got the impression he's a materialist, by which I mean he only believes that material things exist. He alluded to that on a couple of occasions,
and he might say that he has no good reason to believe that there is anything beyond.
Sure. And he also sort of jumped into evolutionary explanations for humanity a couple of times. And that's not to say that I don't think evolution has a role to play in things. We're not going down that particular discussion. But for Ian, it's evolution and nothing else. So the one of the challenges I'd have loved to put to Ian if we had more time, and you never have enough time in these dialogues, is, well, surely if human flourishing is about what we're supposed to be, biologically, if evolution is the only game in town, the only metric then is passing on your DNA to the next generation and having descendants who thrive and then can pass on their DNA, the kind of Richard Dawkins kind of selfish gene idea. Really, you have this sort of biological determinism. That's all we're about. And anything outside of that is nothing more than an illusion. And so Ian may think that he's free. He used the word autonomy a few times, but he's not autonomous. He's just he's a collection of atoms blown by the winds of, you know, time and chance and chaos, subject to the same laws of physics that determine the makeup of the atoms of this table in front of us.
Yeah, I think you mean we all are, given his view.
On his worldview. Yeah. So where does this talk of freedom and autonomy and flourishing, what does that even mean in a purely mechanistic worldview?
Which I think is such an important question, particularly when we hear from the atheist community at large. I'm hearing so much more talk about determinism and much more of this buy-in of a deterministic worldview. And you just can't help but wonder, I mean, what is autonomy on a materialistic, deterministic worldview that just like, you know, particles in motion? What's autonomy on that? I mean, what exactly is freedom? And then I think some really important questions become significant, such as, how do you condemn a totalitarian regime that's seeking to take away your freedom when they could simply ask, what freedom are you talking about? Again, it's getting back to this idea of, what sort of things did you come into the world with? This inherent idea, did you come into the world with dignity? Did you come into the world with equality? Did you come into the world with inalienable rights, you know, rights that can't be taken away? Again, it gets us back to that question. Well, why is that the case, particularly on a materialistic worldview?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's a whole series of other things that flow from there. But one thing I wanted to talk about that you just mentioned there, Andy, that we did actually touch on a little bit last night, but again, just to dive more deeply into it on the podcast, this whole idea of autonomy. I think, firstly, I don't think on a materialistic worldview you have freedom. But I also want to say, as a Christian, I want to push back a little bit on this sort of view of freedom that our atheist friends have. Because it's interesting, when you talk to atheists and humanists for a long time, freedom is a big thing. They want to be free. They don't want some divine, you know, sort of bully in the sky, tyrant in the sky, telling them what to do. You know, Ian basically said words.
Well, that came out last night.
That came out last night, right?
Yeah.
But I want to sort of say to that, just a moment, actually. Firstly, I'm not so sure that utter autonomy is human flourishing. Firstly, it's demonstrably not true, even if you don't go the deterministic route, the materialistic route. As Christians, I want to be saying, you know, I'm deeply enmeshed in community. The only reason I'm here as a functioning 45-year-old is I had parents who raised me. I had a community who cared for me. I'm now a dad. I'm now responsible for two young children. I'm not free to do entirely as I want. Or if I behave in that way, there's going to be drastic repercussions in the lives of two people who depend on me for a whole series of things. And so this idea that we can be autonomous, I think, is the great lie. And it's very interesting that the famous, you know, French atheist Albert Camus, you know, one of his lesser known books is The Rebel. And he talks in there about the fact that every human being is in a state of rebellion, basically. And I think he's right. That I think that's the ultimate lie. That was the lie in the garden. That Satan whispered to Adam and Eve, you can be free, you don't need God. You can construct moral reality for yourself. You can, you know, define good and evil. You can be like God. And I think that ultimately is the big difference, the big dividing line behind all of this between Christianity and secular humanism.
I think there is a difference between freedom from God and freedom in God. And I often thought about freedom in that sense. I'm like, okay, well, freedom is a moral concept. And as a moral concept, it has to have boundaries. I may have certain positive freedoms, like, you know, my freedom to swing my arm. But then you guys have your negative freedom, right? Freedom from being punched in the nose. So it's got to have some boundaries.
This also, I think, brings us back to what we've talked on earlier with regards to what is the purpose of this? What's the end goal? Because I think this is one area where people misunderstand the Christian worldview, where they see God as running his own totalitarian regime, where he stands on high and gives out his commands and says, thou shalt do this. But what it's not taking into account is this idea of what it means to be a human being, what leads to human flourishing again. Because the idea that the Bible continues to talk about is that humanity was created to live in relationship with God and relationship with each other. And so what you see then is a God that's leading you towards your flourishing, in which there are natural repercussions where you will not flourish, and less so about this idea of a God who, and this got brought up in the dialogue last night, particularly with the Euthyphro dilemma, with this God who's just arbitrarily grabbing these rules saying, this is what I want you to do and this is what I don't want you to do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's interesting, right, when Jesus was asked, you know, about the greatest commandment, right? And, you know, like any good apologist, he answered one question with two answers. And but, you know, I know some people say, well, why did Jesus pick those two, love God and love your neighbor? Because I think everything does hang on that, because it's relationally driven, right? If you love God, that does a number of things. You know who God is. From that flows, you know who you are. Your identity is secure, and that's a huge issue in our culture right now about who we are. Well, you know, that answers that question. You are a creator. You are a child of the Most High, mm-hmm. who loves you dearly and demonstrates that on the cross. And then out of that relationship with God flows the horizontal relationships with each other. And so if you get those two pieces right, in one sense, you don't need the rest of the law and the prophets. They will hang on.
Yeah, which on Jesus
those two,
says.
Which is what Jesus says. Everything else hangs on those. Get those two pieces right. Or I think it was Augustine who paraphrased it by saying, you know, love God and then do as you like. In other words, if you genuinely loved God, then you could be trusted to do entirely.
And I think it's significant, and this was brought up, Andy, with the idea that we were made in the image and likeness of God. And what kind of an image were we made in? Well, we were made in the image of a relational God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You know, it shouldn't surprise us then that Jesus' answer was, you know, love God and love people. I mean, this is what you were not only created for, this is the image you were created from, a relational image for a relational purpose. And this gets us back, by the way, I feel like we kind of full circle here, back to this idea of human rights. I mean, when we're talking about how should a human live, well, we're talking about how should you live, you know, what's going to lead to flourishing in the sense that, particularly when we talk about morality, how are we going to live in right relationships with one another? That's a significant question for us to begin to work out. Like, well, what does, it gets us back to the idea, well, what does right relationship look like? What's the standard?
Yeah. And in all of that, you know, there's a very old and, I was going to say famous, but actually it's not so famous anymore, a very old illustration that C.S. Lewis used to use about ethics that I think is really helpful because it ties all these things together. You know, Lewis, if you come across this one, you know, uses the illustration of a fleet of ships out sail on the ocean and talks about there's three types of instructions. There's three things those ships need. They need to know how to repair themselves if things go wrong. And that kind of relates to personal ethics. We need to know just how to live in a way that, you know that we ourselves thrive. The ships need instructions for how to deal with each other. Like if two ships are coming towards each other, who gives way to whom? And that's a kind of societal ethics. We need to work out how to live in community and so on and so forth. And Lewis says, you know, both those things are important. But there's a third thing that fleet of ships need to know. They need to know why they're out in the ocean in the first place. And that's the question that always gets missed in ethics. And unless you are going to answer that question, those other two questions almost become slightly incidental. And so I think for our humanist friends, all of this to me comes back to that question of what does it mean to be human? What are we here for? What is the purpose of human life? And if there is none, which I think you are ultimately left with on humanism, then I do really wonder if anything else you try and build ultimately unravels because you have no foundation.
And on the Christian worldview, why are the ships out at sea? What is the purpose of all this?
Yeah. Well, in one sense, I think the answer to the purpose of all this, in some ways, I like to say, from a Christian perspective, is both beautifully simple and infinitely wonderfully complex. And the answer I always begin with is this. It's this idea that the heart of human flourishing, the reason we're here, is to know God, to love God and enjoy him forever. I think that's been the classical Orthodox Christian answer. Now, that's beautifully simple. You can sum it up in a sentence. You could even tweet it. Of course, you know, now there's a 280 character limit on Twitter, so you can do whole sermons. But on the old way, you could tweet it. But also then unpacking what that means, it's not simplistic. And I think sometimes our humanistic friends think that Christians are simplistic and we need to be careful of, you know, of glib answers. But yeah, it's to have that relationship with God, to not just know about God, but to know him, and then for that to unfold not just through our lives, but then into eternity. So to know God and to enjoy him forever, that's what it means to be human.
Well, that's a good place to wrap up. I know that when we talk about these kinds of issues, like when we're discussing ideas and a person's name is attached often, it's really easy to slip into this mindset of, you know, attacking the person. But one comment that I consistently got last night from different people that I interacted with, one thing always came up was both speakers were really respectful and the conversation was cordial. And we had nothing but respect for Ian for being there, coming to a church, no less, to represent his view. So
he even said to us that he looks forward to working with us again in the future. So
yeah,
it's a great win.
Yeah, we want to say again, thank you to Ian Bushfield for coming out to dialogue with us on this. I'm sure, you know, there are lots of things that we said here that he disagrees with, but that's fine. We can continue the dialogue in whatever format. With that said, if you missed the conversation, the human rights dialogue between Andy Bannister and Ian Bushfield, that event was video recorded, and we're going to include it as a bonus on our conference digital recording. If you're listening to this, the conference has already come and gone, but the conference digital recordings will be available online, so you can go to apologeticscanada.com/store. Check that out. And again, the human rights dialogue between Andy and Ian will be there as a bonus. We'll leave you there today. Thank you so much for joining us, listeners, and thank you, Andy Bannister.
Great to be with you guys.
For joining us here as a guest today. Thank you, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. And until then, ciao.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.